Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird, really.
How's everyone? How was Rabbi Nevin's last week?
Very good. Awesome.
Very good.
Stop. Very interesting.
Yeah. Good. I hope so. I would have liked to have been here myself to learn, but I also loved where we were. That is Mazel Tov again to Jay and Leslie, and also to Bernsteins, who are part of our community, while he's even over there at Park Avenue Synagogue, on being honored at the Schechter Dinner, Schechter Manhattan, where they, thank God, my kids are learning a little Talmud in the middle school. So the other piece is that I thought of some of the learning that you're doing in Eruvin. You know, Eruvin is the new Daf Yomi Masechet of Talmud.
Daf Yomi Differential, or whatever it's called.
So Daf Yomi, yeah, Differently, or something like that, is what Danny Nevins, Rabbi Nevins, was talking about. Daf Yomi Differently. There's the Daf Yomi, I guess, traditionally, that I've been learning, and I teach a little bit of at the end of a lot of the daily minyan days. And we were just saying before, among the things that are beautiful about Talmudic learning is that the rabbis were really about having us invoke our imaginations. So on Daf 11, which was a couple days ago, the page of the day of Eruvin, there's also, of course, the Jewish culture that comes out with these things. So very technical argument. Should a gateway, a doorway with an arch, have a mezuzah on the lintel?
Because it's not a straight lintel?
Well, because, right, it's not a straight lintel. So immediately the question, you have to know what the question is. So Bobby says, I know the question. You mean if I have an arch like this, it's not a straight lintel that goes in a rectangular format. So now they say, and by the way, there are two kinds of arches. They're the ones that are kind of keystone, both have keystones in this case, and both have the kind of bricks that we call a typical arch in this matter, and there are lots of different other kinds of arches, but let's just say we're talking about that kind of arch.
I think a Roman is called.
Right? And the difference we're talking about is whether or not it goes up brick by brick by brick in the keystone, and there's no fixture above that, no concrete, no stone, no working that then goes up on top of that, because some of them are just freestanding, almost like decorative, right? Arches. So the argument goes that if you have lintels and it's a doorway and that they continue, or it's just freestanding lintel and the arch goes up like this and there's no build up around that arch, there's just this, then I really can't see in that the potential for a rectangular doorway, because I have to be able to, in essence, see that I could chip away the kind of triangular portion of the concrete on top of it.
Why does it have to be rectangular? Remind me or us.
Well, the rabbis are already saying that they saw as the entranceway to the Mishkan and or the Beit HaMikdash, whichever one you're really learning from here in the Sechet Eruvin, that since those were rectangular, that when I create the form of a doorway, either fully with materials or even just by putting a board across an alleyway, then it becomes a rectangular kind of shape. So this question...
Even though the mitzvah was made before either of those structures existed.
Well, the mitzvah is learned from those structures. In other words, the mitzvah of Eruv, we learn because we were given certain mitzvot to build this and do that, and thusly, we ultimately learn how to build an Eruv in a now build-up of our home dwellings that share a mavoi, an alleyway. So mezuzah, as a mitzvah, applies to the doorpost. If I say that this is truly a doorpost, I have the mitzvah of mezuzah, which is given long before. If I say that it's not a doorpost, because this arch, without any kind of build-up around it, sits there kind of as one of these, you know, I call that the modern look, right? In other words,
it's kind of a linear thing. It's not part of our...
It's an arch, but there's no lintel at all.
There's no structure. It's only like a line without a building around it.
Correct. It's like a line of stones. And so the question is...
There's no wall above it. He means that it's not a freestanding wall.
No, I think he means there's no wall attached to it.
I'm going to draw it to you.
Like this,
without the wall. I'm going to draw it to you. Here's the difference.
One. Let's see, because that's what I'm...
Version A. Here is, in essence, the doorway, right? The passageway.
Oh, with nothing across?
And then, imagine... Just that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like alleys. They have that in Israel, in Jerusalem, like those alleys with the thing across.
But here, not only is there an arch and a keystone, but there's actually a wall. If, halachically, I have to put a mezuzah here, is the question. They say for this one, since there's none of this wall that I could imagine actually chipping away at all this and making this rectangular format, I don't have to put a mezuzah here. It's in essence not a doorway. Because when I use my imagination to hollow out the triangles that are created here, I get this rectangular shape, then I'm obligated to mezuzah.
So where does Visharecha fit into this? What do you need to be a shaar?
Well, Visharecha is kind of a doorway in this case. At least the assumption is in this page of the Gemara. But it's an open question. Nonetheless, this is what they say is the halacha as far as that page goes. And sometimes you get that in the Gemara. Page 11b, this is what they say. And then the piece at the bottom of the page says, but don't tell Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Don't tell Rabbi Judah the Exilarch. Because if you go into his place, this is what he has. And by the way, he's got a mezuzah on the door. You know, this is the culture of the Talmud. Coming through. The culture of the Jewish people. You want to call this a doorway? Rabbi Yehuda calls this a doorway. If I went with Rabbi Yehuda, call it a doorway. But the general savara, the thinking and the legal conclusion at that point, and we're not talking that this is kadific law, halacha lamasek, talking this is the conversation. This is what it is. So, fantastic kind of discussion in Eruvin. I hope that you got a nice taste of what Eruvin is, or either, you know, at that spot where Rabbi Nevins was holding. But it's an interesting Gemara. It's an interesting Gemara in and of itself. Philosophically, the concept of the question is, can we create a community in which we all carry? Because carrying was a no-no on Shabbat. Can we create a community in which we all can carry to one another's places food to eat on a Sabbath? So by doing an Eruv, sharing in a cooked item, and creating this area that we connect doorway to doorway without having to really build lintels, that creates the Eruv. So I saw there were a few things that went around. Maybe you sent around a
Rabbi Wexler told me once that we were the only conservative synagogue in New York who supported the Eruv.
And we do, and we continue to. And I came, and I got a note from the Eruv Commission. This is a good story. And I wrote them a check from whatever discretionary funds, because I really believe in this construct of creating Jewish community. And Rabbi Wexler said, you know, there are a few things that I think you'll support. And in fact, we were on the page. Because this, as an area of law, is one of those distinctions for us as a people. It's not a loophole. We've talked about loopholes versus distinctions. This is, in ancient times, we would create the boundaries of our communities so that within them we could be with one another.
What is an island need a neighbor?
That's a big article in Jewish law and contemporary society, which has been investigated time and again. The prevailing opinion is that you have certain passageways that create such a public thoroughfare that you have sections here and that the island can't be considered one. If you believe that way, then you need to, in your section of the community, connect it. If you don't believe that that's a problem, you could say that since it's an island, and whether or not you believe a bridge then connects it to the mainland in a permanent way, is also a rabbinic argument.
Does there have to be a residence behind there for it to require?
Yeah, the assumption is that this is the entrance to a courtyard in which different apartments exist. For the mezuzah discussion itself, by the way, if you walk through a gateway, whether there's an apartment building back there or not, some people would hold it makes no difference since it says b'sha'arecha. Some people say, no, you put a mezuzah where you live, right? And that's the prevailing halachic opinion, that rooms in which you live get a mezuzah, rooms that are just for impermanent use, like a bathroom, do not. And then there's a machloket about a shul, whether or not it truly requires mezuzah, or it's just a gateway that you walk through, that you make, in essence, a home for prayer, and thusly it also requires mezuzah. So some do and some don't.
Are you permitted to have a mezuzah where it's not required to be?
As long as it's not a place of bizui, as long as it's not a place where there's anything that... Yeah. But whether, like a bathroom, or a place where you bring soiled items, or a place where there's wine that's used for a libation, or other kind of religious purposes.
No, but following up with the, I think what you're getting at, you're not supposed to do extra, you're not supposed to do things that aren't required,
right? Here on this building, Rabbi, certainly was of the opinion it's not required at all. I think because...
So isn't there a concept
of lotos? Well, you're talking about a concept of lotos that you shouldn't add.
Yeah.
This concept, thought of in an overarching general way from the vocabulary of translation, could mean to us never veer, right? That's not exactly it. It's the construct might be, in this case, don't take a mezuzah and think that the parchment has to be as large as this all the time, and you can't make it like this. You know, if already we have halakha that said it could be as small or as large, don't cut off the small and now say only this. That doesn't sound like an addition, right? That sounds like actually taking something away, but that's what it kind of gets at. In other words, if we fulfill the law a certain way, don't limit the fulfillment of the law, as opposed to the natural way we might think of don't add, which is, by the way, you could also have this. That is also baltosid. In other words, don't make the fill in a different way and add one to it if we already have a way. But it also means don't limit the way you fulfill the law. A little bit different philosophically. Back to our Gemara. I said we're going to become wine experts. Because the Gemara, as we know, said... We are on page 70A3. No, I'm sorry, 70A2. We just said in our Mishnah that if he drinks Italian wine and he eats this meat, then he becomes a glutton and he becomes then a drunkard. And he also becomes someone that's gonna lead to murder, and we can't have that. Otherwise, he's a ben sover more. But again, keeping in mind philosophically, the rabbis are always looking to limit this. And in today's shiur, today's class, I want to point out that sometimes the rabbis take the opportunity to explore the ancient text and ancient poetry and issue that comes about in the general and more broad sense when it comes up in a conversation that is legally connected to a certain category. So in the categorical discussion of Ben Sorer and Moray, we started talking about wine, and now we're going to investigate some of what we understand about wine, alcohol, the poetry of different parts of the Tanakh that mention it, and what we might think about it in general. Because why? We know that wine is used in our tradition for sacramental purposes. We know that there's Arba Kosot coming up. There's four cups on Pesach. We know that wine is that which gladdens the heart. On the other hand, we're saying wine can lead to terrible places.
I find it strange that if wine is so central, okay, you know, to our sacrificial system, none of it is used in the Korban that we've read about last week.
Yeah. Well, that's because in Parshat Shmini, when Aaron's sons actually offer the strange fire, there are those who say the reason why there it says, don't drink any wine and become drunk in your offerings and while you're doing your holy work, is because there was an abuse of wine to begin with. So, having that in our minds as well, in the texture of our relationship to this, is also important. Because in Torah, that's where we get the introduction to the notion that it wouldn't be involved. So we said last week that Rav Huna, speaking of wine, remember that so thick it was diluted and a little undiluted. And if he drank that, no worries. Except for Ravina and Rav Huna. And when he ate meat that's cooked but not fully cooked, that was like the scorched meat of thieves. They had little time to eat, so they scorched it. I'm on the bottom right-hand side of 78-2. Rabba and Rav Yosef both said, Rabba Rav Yosef, the Amrei Tarvaihu, Aval Basar Maliach Vishatayayin Megito, if a boy ate salted meat and drank wine fresh from its wine press, Ein Nase Ben Sorer More, he does not become Ben Sorer More. So if I have that he's eating salted meat and he's eating and he's drinking wine that's fresh from its press, then I have no worries. What's wine fresh from its press taste like?
Good. Bad. I don't know.
Wine fresh from its press isn't aged. It hasn't become rich with the fruits. It hasn't become a wine that draws him after and causes him to mamshich. Remember, there's this verb in our Gemara that says, if you drink Italian wine, you will be mamshich acharav. You will try to run after it and chase it, and you'll want to drink more. And then you'll get so caught up in trying to get the wine.
Rabbi, I'm sorry, I have a different version of anything you took. So is this ayin aleph?
This is ayin.
Ayin, okay.
Amud Aleph. Okay, I'm going to say it's in the wide lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down. Amar Rav Huna Eino Chayav Ad Shiyocha Basar Chayav V'yishte Yayin, right?
I got it.
Yishte Yayin Chay. Eini, really? V'ha Rab of Rav Yosef Damri Tarvayu Achal Basar Chay V'shati Yayin Chay Eino Nase Ben Tzolga Morei. But there's a response that Rav Yosef says that if he drinks this and he eats that, he's not a Ben Sora More. And then Amar Ravina, Yayin Chai. What is Yayin Chai? Mazik velo mazik. It's wine that's been a little bit diluted, but not all the way diluted. And Basar Chai, Bashil velo bashil. And meat that's chai, that's raw. No, not raw, a little cooked, but not so cooked. Kabasar Kiyavi Dachle Gande. You with me? If you have the version?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Then it comes this teaching. Rabba Rav Yosef to Amri Tarvaihu. So Rabba, again, to repeat it. Rabba and Rav Yosef say, the two of them, Achal Basar Maliach, if he eats meat that's salted and drinks wine right straight from the press, Ein Nase Ben Sora More. He's not made into this Ben Sora More. I have no concern that what? That these things will draw him after them, that he will become gluttonous, and he will become a drunkard. And thus,
because
they don't taste good. Okay, next page, 70A3 in the Schattenstein. Now, I have to know what I'm talking about with regard to what? Salted meat, basar maliach, and this kind of wine. First, we're going to deal with the kind of actual foods we're talking about. The Gemara is going to bring a Mishnah that relates to Tisha B'Av. What happens on Tisha B'Av? We mourn the destruction of the temple. Before the fast starts, there's as much of a requirement to eat as to fast.
But no meat.
We can't have meat, nor can we drink wine. Both of them are really symbols of joy and bring about joy. It says in one place in the Gemara, Ein simcha ela babasar. There is no such thing as joy unless you have meat. And in another place in the Talmud it says, Ein simcha ela bayayin. There's no joy except for when you're drinking wine. So we know these traditions. On Tisha B'Av, you can have neither. So the, in the general sense here, what's the inyan? How does it relate possibly to our situation? What if I think that this guy is a ben sorer more? He's a rebellious and a stubborn son. And I walk into one of those meals before Tisha B'Av, and I see him drinking wine and eating meat. Well, can I really call that the kind of meat and the kind of wine that I need to classify him as a venso rerum ore? So I'm going to get it. That's what somebody's thinking here as they bring this up. Okay? I say it that way because ultimately someone's going to say, you're learning from here. We learned in the Mishnah, Tanan Hatam. We learned in the Mishnah, Tanan Hatam. Erev Tisha B'Av, Lo Yochal Adam Shnei Tavshilim. On Erev Tisha B'Av, right before Tisha B'Av fast, a person may not eat two cooked foods. V'lo Yochal Basar, V'lo Yishtei Yayin. And he shouldn't eat meat, nor drink wine. So you eat a very simple meal. You're not supposed to have lots of cooked food. You don't drink wine, nor can you eat meat. The Tana, and concerning the latter prohibition about wine and meat, the Tana taught. What's the Tana again? It's a sage of the Mishnah. Technical term for the rabbis of the Mishnaic era. Aval ochel hu basar maliach v'shote yayin migito. However, a person may do what? He may eat salted meat and drink wine directly from the press. Why? Because neither tastes good. Because that's punishment.
It's not a real basar.
It's not real wine. I have no concern in this case over here by Ben Sorer More, the stubborn and rebellious son, that he's going to run after these things and it's going to start him on a life of gluttony and drunkenness.
But it had not a shadow to me. Sure, it's green as well. But he is a glutton and a drunkard. That's the only reason the question is coming up.
Well, we're thinking he might be, and we're even saying maybe his parents are going to call him a Ben Sorer More and drag him to the Zakanian. But if I'm the parents, I'm learning from these Mishnayot how I have to make distinctions. I thought he was really a glutton. He's sitting there at the Erev Tisha B'Av meal eating some meat and drinking wine. But he's really only drinking Yayin Megito, wine from the press. And he's only really eating Basar Maliach, salted meat. So I can't really say that he fits the category. What is salted meat? So, salted, we're going to get into a little bit, we're going to hear it. But you think about salted meat now and you think, oh, it's good. A little salt. Little taste, little pickling spices. Not exactly what we're talking about here. Meat was salted. That was for preservation.
For kashering too.
But we're talking here now for preservation.
Right, this is after it's already been checked.
Correct. So in order to keep some moisture in it, the salt actually helped. But after a certain amount of time, the moisture would leave it. And it would not only be like jerky, it would be just gone. And if I knew that I brought a certain kind of korban, which we're going to get to, the Gemara is going to say, but I'll tell you in advance, a shlamim offering, which is, there's great peace, I want to make a beautiful offering, I feel full, shalem, shlamim offering. This I can offer. I could eat it through the night. I could eat it through the day. I could eat it a long time versus other things that I had to eat right away or get rid of and burn up on the altar. In order to preserve them, I need to salt it a little bit. But after a certain amount of time, it becomes basar maluach. It becomes so overly done that it's terrible. And it really doesn't fall into the category of succulent meat any longer. Back to the Gemara. Basar maliach had kama, as far as salted meat is concerned, how long after it was salted does it become permitted for consumption on Erev Tisha B'Av? In other words, I checked it, it's succulent, but at a certain point it becomes basar maliach, and then I know I can eat it on Tisha B'Av. Because it's so disgusting. Because it's not going to make for the meal to be any better than if I didn't have it. Ama Rabbi Chanina Bar Kahana, Rabbi Chanina Bar Kahana says, Kol Zman Shehu B'Shlamim, as long as it resembles the Shlamim offering, it does not have the status of salted meat, and it may not be eaten at the concluding meal of Erev Tisha B'Av. So, the Shlamim offering, if you look over in the Rashi, those on the page, it's about halfway down, Kol Zman Shehu K'Shlamim. Shelo avar alav zman achilat shlamim shnei yamim v'layla echad adayim. That the time that it could have been eaten as a shlamim offering, which is 2 days and a night, didn't pass belichutohu v'lo ikri maliach. It's still succulent and somewhat in its juicy format. And it's not called maliach yet. It's not called salted. Mishameach et halev. And it rejoices the heart. It causes the heart to rejoice. Therefore, I can't eat it on Erev Tisha B'Av. Only after it's maliach can I eat it. Dichtiv, as it says in the Torah, Vizavachta shlamim v'achalta sham v'samachta. And you offered the offering, you ate the offering, and you became one who's rejoicing, one full of joy. Alma, we see then from here, Bar Simchahu, that he would become a person who is full of joy. Aval Batar Hachi, but after that period of time that we say that the Shlamim offering was succulent, Have Maliach, the meat was salted and therefore not succulent, and we could eat it at the Suda Masekeh, the Suda, the meal before Tisha B'Av. V'nechlaf tamo b'melacho, and the taste goes out and the saltiness comes in. So that is a little bit about the basar. And therefore, if I saw him eating that, I wouldn't worry. The Gemara continues. V'yein megito ad kama, and as far as wine from its press is concerned, how long is it considered fresh and thus permitted for consumption at the concluding meal? Kol zman shehu toses, as long as it is still fermenting. And it may be drunk at the concluding meal then. So why, when it's still fermenting, can it be drunk? And even if it was a little bit alcohol, it doesn't taste good. In that part of the process, it doesn't taste good. And Rashi, who's a vintner, tells us what happens when you drink such wine in the next Rashi entry. Kol zaman shehu toses. I'm just below the Rashi I read now on the right-hand column. It's about middle of the page again. It's in the bold, if you're following. Shehun no shech begaron mechamat shehu machmitz. it bites your throat because of the vinegary nature of the concoction, of the liquid. So a breita then comes and adds, in terms of our understanding of the fermentation process, v'hatanya, and it was taught in a breita, yayin toses ein bo mishum gilui, the law of uncovered liquids does not apply to fermenting wine, v'chama tesisato, and how long does it take to ferment? Shlosha yamim, 3 days. So the 3 day period is the period of 3 days here that the wine takes to ferment. And during those 3 days, the law of what? Uncovered liquids doesn't apply. What is that law? That law is a law that says the following. I'm worried about liquids that I'm preparing if I'm a vintner or I'm a liquid manager, any kind, alcoholic liquids, oils, any kind of other kind of shechar, mead that I'm preparing that has both the alcohol and the proteins in it, that I'm worried that a reptile is going to crawl into my barrel. I'm worried that it's going to make it tamei, that it's going to cause an impurity. Such a concoction that's in the middle of its tesisa, in its fermentation, I'm not so worried. The snake will take one taste of it, run away. It's so noshech, it's so bites at the throat, it's so sour, not even the smell attracts a reptile. So really I'm kidding about the sip, because if it took a sip we'd be in trouble. It won't even go near it. And because it won't even go near it, I say that it's migito, say that it's wine from the press, and that the fermentation process takes 3 days. And therefore, I don't worry that he's drinking such a concoction. Because he's not going to be mamshich acharav with the Italian wine, remember.
So the idea of yayin, uncovered wine, is not... You're not supposed to drink it, but this kind of uncovered wine you can.
You're really like, who would drink such a thing to begin with? But if he's drinking it already, we don't even call it wine. Because this isn't wine. We know what good wine tastes like. It comes from Italy. And by the way, we also know that if it's not Italian wine, according to Rav Huna, with Ravina's explanation, it's at least wine that was somewhat diluted, but not all the way diluted, that we're really worried about. That he's drinking strong, potent stuff and looking for a high. So the rabbis are interested in why you're drawing Tisha B'Av into my discussion. Because can I really learn anything from that? Okay, so it seems like there's a good parallel. Seems like that.
You're learning that it's out of the normal definition, because if it's allowed on Tisha B'Av, then it's not even in that category. It's something that's completely different and completely undesirable.
But also, if you were to consider the young man truly a more...
Ben Sorero Moray.
Well, then it's a catastrophe. And I think what they're equating is the catastrophe of one life being that out of bounds is as catastrophe as the temple being destroyed. Because we have the concept of one life.
That's right.
Is a whole world.
And since the philosophical underpinning is that this one life is so important, what they're asking, because sometimes we have to understand what their question is, it's not whether or not I can learn from Tisha B'Av to my situation where I'm also talking about Basar V'Yayin, where I'm talking about meat and wine. Their real question is what if my laws about meat and wine are even more forgiving when it comes to Ben Sorer and Moreh, then your laws about meat and wine as they apply to Tisha B'Av. That's now the question the Gemara is going to ask. A little different than just, can I really do, you know, hacha v'hatam. Here and there. The Gemara, on the one hand, to a reader, might sound as though they're saying, hacha mai. But what about in our case? Are you saying that these laws apply? A person might start to go the direction of thinking, in terms of Talmudic learning, oh, they're going to obviously now reject any kind of learning that I can do from Tisha B'Av, because it seems a different kind of situation. Here, there, it's a holiday. Yeah. What they're saying is a little bit more nuanced. They're saying, but here, what if I have different traditions about meat and wine? And can I think more that in this area of the law, I could be a little bit even more forgiving? Because by the end of the section, it's going to be more days that wine can be considered betisisa, fermenting. If I have wine now that's instead of 3 days, 30 days, I have more of a chance that he's drinking something that basically is not a great bottle of wine. And therefore I could say, hey, I don't have to see this guy as a drunkard. If I can say that basar becomes maliach even faster than the time it took for the shlamim offering to get salty, then I have a way, philosophically, of getting down to the core root of what the discussion is here, which is this one soul. How could we possibly define him like this? Thus the Gemara continues.
Wasn't the argument in the previous Mishnah that if the quality of the wine is good and the quality of the meat is good, it's not a prize, not a mitzvah, because it's too expensive. You can't make a habit of drinking quality anyway. Wasn't that the argument they made, or did I misunderstand?
Could have been one piece of the argument where they said, but I'll tell you, even with cheaper wine, it's gonna matter.
Okay, so here we have a case of...
Could be. But over here, we're worried because someone sees him doing this stuff, and we're saying, is he really doing it or not? And since I can define the stuff he's drinking and eating out of the category of what I'm worried about, it's good for us philosophically, in the sense that we want to kind of save him from being categorized as this guy, as this Ben Sorer.
It's more a social kind of engineered argument, because we don't want to...
Yeah, there is that. I believe that there's truly that. It's hard to say that all the way. You'd have scholars argue with, you know, my whole take that we're philosophically only in that mode. Maybe there's a legal debate here, which of these laws should we really apply. But I think that because it comes afterwards in terms of the argument, that ultimately they're trying to arrive at a more expansive look at where these are. Okay, so let's look at how that works. 78.3, second column, Hachamai. But with regard to Ben Sorer Moreh here, in other words, our case of Ben Sorer Moreh, what's the law? Are salted meat and fresh wine defined the same way for a Ben Sorer Moreh as they are for Erev Tisha B'Av or not? Hatam, over there, in other words, with the case of Erev Tisha B'Av, Mishum Simchahu, it's because of Simcha, of joy, and the production of joy, that he's not allowed to eat these things. Kolzman shehu kishlamim. We use the measure of the shlamim offering. Nami eat beis simcha, and there's still joy involved in eating it. And therefore, it's forbidden to eat that meat at the concluding meal unless it's been salted for a longer period than that offering. Hacha, in our case of Ben Sorer Moreh, mishum im shuchayhu. Here, it's because we say that that is the meat that will draw him after being a glutton. That's the reason we're worried. V'chol shehu lo mimshich, but a boy won't be drawn to meat that was salted even for a small amount of time. V'yayin ad arba'in yom. And I could have wine that's 40 days old, and it wouldn't be wine that actually made him feel like he should go out, run, and buy 16 bottles of this case, because I'm only going to find it once. this year, this fermenting, this process, you know, this wine. So I don't worry about that. Over here, you know, don't tell me it's only 3 days, according to your Brita. It's 40 days. I have a different measure. So that's now the kind of, that's the end of the conversation in a certain way. It's a hacha and a hatam. A here and a there. And where I don't want to have to say, and the halacha is like this, which I didn't. Gemara didn't come out and say, and halacha is like so and so. I compare the two, and I make that the last thing that's said. And thusly, I have the literary quality of saying, I've now expanded the period of time and I'm not worried. So, Ad Kan. I think we've asked some questions about this. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to now push forward to the area in the Gemara where they say, hey, by the way, we're really talking about wine here. Now let's explore wine. Now let's look at some of the verses and the poetry we have about wine. And let's think about, and I want to put it in this context as well, let's think about the reality that we really do have alcoholic beverages in the world. You know, fast forward it to America. We've got alcohol all over. What are we going to do? Are we going to have prohibition? Or are we not going to have prohibition? Are we going to try this as an area of the law? Are we going to take every verse in the Tanakh about joy of wine and say there's a way to make grape juice without alcoholic properties? That's the only thing that we should give Jewish people to drink? How are we going to relate to this, and I'll even say, very ancient reality that alcoholic beverages exist in the world? How are we going to use it within our corpus of texts? What verses are we going to allow to hold the concretization of the use of the sacramental wine, of the wine in anyone's life? Shall we make a blessing for it? A separate blessing for it? Will that blessing be for the fact that it has joyful quality? Or is that blessing for it a separate blessing because we're saying both it has joy and be careful? That the reminder of the fact that it's the fruit of the vine is the reminder not only of its potential to turn into this beautiful kos yayin, beautiful cup of wine, but its potential to cause damage and destruction in the world. This is now the exploration of the Gemara. It's a fascinating exploration here. We get lots of verses and explorations of the power of wine. We get now a throwback to the story of Noah, where it's going to be the core exploration, not only in the Gemara, but in rabbinic literature itself, the core exploration of alcohol, alcoholism, the dangers and the power of alcohol. So we're going to get into some of that. This was, as I said, a concrete reality in the time of the rabbis. They knew about wine. But I wanted to, before we jump into this section, let me pass this out. I'm sorry, I didn't pass this out right now. Can you take one of these and pass it down that way? So I brought for us today a source packet, some literature. The first page is a page that we're not going to get to yet. It's a page from a Hasidic source that is in Hebrew. If you flip the page open, you see it says, one, homo imbibens. I drink, therefore I am. This is chapter one from this book. I'm sorry I didn't write the title on it, but if you'd like to take a note, this is chapter one from this book. It's called Uncorking the Past. It is a study, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages by Patrick E. McGovern. It's a fantastic study, a follow-up to his book, Ancient Wine. Published 2009 by the Regents of the University of California. There's a nice index. There are a bibliography of sources for each chapter. It's written in a more popular form so that they're not mega footnotes, but each chapter is it's got its own bibliography. So, it's called Uncorking the Past. Patrick McGovern. So, the rabbis are part of this larger world. They understand that they have to relate to wine. Astronomers probing our galaxy with powerful radio waves have discovered that alcohol does not exist only on Earth. Massive clouds of methanol, ethanol, and vinyl ethanol, measuring billions of kilometers across, have been located in interstellar space and surrounding new star systems. One cloud, denoted Sagittarius B2N, is located near the center of the Milky Way, some 26,000 light years or 150 quadrillion miles away from the Earth. While the distant location ensures that humans will not be exploiting extraterrestrial ethanol anytime soon, the magnitude of this phenomenon has excited speculation about how the complex carbon molecules of life on Earth were first formed. Scientists hypothesize that the vinyl ethanol molecules in particular, with their more chemically reactive double bonds, might have been held in place on interstellar dust particles. Now, I bring you this in chapter 1, and not only the chapter about wine production in ancient Canaan, which I'm about to read from, because I think that there is something very, very evident by way of the Talmudic project, by way of our Tanakh. We are exploring central building blocks of life. We're exploring central fundamental elements of creation, the building blocks we have that are apparent to us because of God's greatness. Alcohol and alcoholic beverage is one of them. The traces of alcohol and fermentation processes and how different animals found the sugars and the fermented sugars of different fruit because of the way that the saps were pouring out are traced in the book. And the notion that we've always lived with a certain amount of imbibing, and our animal life as well as human life has lived with a certain amount of imbibing alcoholic beverage as a fundamental experience of existence, is written about in these chapters that begin the book. And the rabbis were very well aware, and as the Tanakh makes evident and the Gemara discusses, were very aware that there's a certain kind of perception about reality and what it holds that changes with the imbibing of alcohol. And it's a fascinating kind of thing to think about. If you go back all the way to where this author is going back and the study that he's trying to reveal, what kind of experiences were people looking for? Who had them? The notion of Italian wine being the thing that is drawing this kid's attention and will make him run after it and become addicted and then even kill for it because he'll be so impassioned by it. There is a chapter in the book that traces some of the, what do you call, strong brews? The strong brews. And the stronger brew. The much heralded hallucinatory proclivities of Neolithic Europeans are still hypothetical and much in need of confirmatory evidence, as argued by British archaeologists Andrew Sherratt and Richard Rudgley. Nordic grog was often spiked with opium from the latex of poppy seed capsules, marijuana from the hemp plant, henbane of deadly nightshade. And this hypothesis is attractive because the megalithic passage and chambered tombs which preceded the great henges are centered around stela and large basins carved with entopic shapes. In other words, they found some of these in some of the ancient places, some evidence in containers. And if you think about what the rabbis are worried about, we're not just maybe talking about your everyday wine. Maybe it was a code word for wine that had some kind of greater, stronger brew, some kind of hallucinatory even possibility within it, and that it was, in a sense, part of the drug culture of their day. So that is one possibility. We have not found necessarily evidence of such strong brew. As he says, it needs more work archaeologically to recover the samples. But where did we know that recovering samples can lead us to more understanding about ancient wines? Because off the coast of Israel, he tells, we found a ship that was... Right, they had about 150 wine vessels in it. And that the Phoenicians and the Greeks were among the people who were importing and exporting after all these Euro-Asian vines were planted, and that some of that wine that was found there was very strong because you could scrape from the inside. And you could understand the fine wines of Canaan and Phoenicia, which he talks about. The 30,000 or more liters of wine lost when the Tanit and Elisa sank represent just a trickle of the huge quantity of wine exported from Phoenician ports such as Tyre, Sidon, Berytus, modern Beirut, and Byblos during the first millennium BC. Most ships would have arrived safely at their destinations, having loaded and offloaded an impressive array of goods en route. When the biblical prophet Ezekiel exuriated Tyre in the 6th century BC and predicted its doom, he compared the prosperous city-state with a huge seagoing vessel fashioned from the best woods, juniper and cedar from the mountains of Lebanon, oak from Transjordan, cypress from Cyprus. The metaphorical ship is described as loaded with incense, gold, camels from Arabia, wheat and olive oil from Israel, tin and silver from Tarshish, horses and slaves from Anatolia, and more, a seemingly endless list of merchandise from the far-flung corners of the known world. So we had nautical archaeologists identify the ship. They found upon it all kinds of different goods, including the astonishing wealth of the cargo, in addition to the wine decanters. And so we understand from this time period the production of really great wine. Now, why do you have the word Italian? So I want to purport that back in our Mishnah when we said Italian wine, it was because who was colonizing the rabbis in their time? The Romans. And it wasn't because they were drinking any kind of Chianti that happened to be the best Chianti in the world. But really, it's the wine of the area that was so strong, developed over time, wines that were, in essence, very decent, good wines that did have some propensity to, you know, kind of draw people into a culture of wine drinking. It was the wine of banquets in ancient Phoenicia and in ancient Rome. We know Greeks as well, who enjoyed such wine, and perhaps the regulation of wine in general from our tradition, saying to use it for different points within the liturgical cycle, for ritual, for the way we enumerate even four kosot at the Seder, but otherwise, do you really need four kosot? The question's begged. These are the kind of realities that the rabbis are dealing with if we think in the broad sweep about wine and rabbinic culture.
I was just going to say that, you know, in Greece, which obviously influenced the area in terms of everything from the afikomen and the dipping and all of that, the wine is associated with Dionysus and Bacchus. They were cults, and they were encouraged to drink a lot, to be hallucinogenic, to lose control. And so that's one model of excessive and religious drinking. There was, you know, Dionysian cults.
Sounds
of
like
drinking. Forum. Yeah, it's like every day is forum for them when they're religious. And then on the other hand, the Muslims completely rejected it. And they are, what, about 600 or something?
Mm-hmm, about that.
So, you know, by then, you've got, and they really emulated a lot of Jewish practice in Islam, but they rejected any alcohol whatsoever. So it's kind of interesting, I think, you know,
mm-hmm.
streams of the Greek, which is really involved with a great deal of wine, and the Muslim.
Yeah.
I think that they rejected women. I mean, that they could have many women. They rejected wine, could have any women. Jay said, that's more reason to have more wine.
What's the origin of kids of drinking wine on holidays and Shabbat?
Well, we know that... Well, it's not going to talk about that exactly here, though. Beautifully, Pesach is coming in the Gemara and Tzachim in Passover, in that area, it talks about a little bit of that. At least talks about the notions of the traditions that we first see about Kiddush. But over here, now we're going to investigate the verses more about them and about the dangers of wine and the alcoholism.
But is there a mitzvah for...
There's a mitzvah for Kiddush. There's a mitzvah for using wine for it.
What's the rationale for it? Is there any...
Because the yayin is, on the one hand, yismach lev adam. It gladdens the heart. And they're saying, though, but you know, if it gladdens the heart, how far might I go? Can I regulate this? And so now, let's get into some of this language of the Gemara.
Well, we say l'chaim, and then we say suffer. L'chaim means for good and not for bad. This is just what we're talking about.
Yes, yes. So, bottom of 78:3. Having stated that wine can bring ruin upon a boy, the Gemara now mentions the constructive use of wine, though. Amar Rav Chanan. Rav Chanan has the following tradition. Lo nivra yayin ba'olam ela l'nachem aveilim u'lishalem sachar l'rishayim. Rav Chanan said, wine is only created in the world to be a source of comfort to the bereaved. And to grant a transient reward to wicked people. So wine, I'm going to explain, as a little bit of that which takes out the sting, used in its medicinal way even, without being excessive, we know, as a barbiturate, calms the nerves. Overdone? Can't work such a way. So Rav Chanan obviously is advocating a controlled kind of use. He also says it's a transient reward for the wicked. Shenemar, as it says, Tenuz Shechar La'oved V'yayin L'marei Nafesh, give intoxicating wine to the wicked one and wine to embittered souls. So what is it really talking about there? The notion here gets back to a whole question in philosophy, in our philosophy, about whether or not the truly wicked get a place in the next world. If you're wicked and you do things, you know, the kind of question that Rabbi Kushner helped us ask, why do bad things happen to good people, and the hefech, the opposite, why do good things happen to such an evildoer? In our tradition, here, the philosophy statement is as follows. If someone's such a schnorrer, if someone's so wicked that you look at them and you say, there's a reward, and they're drinking fine wine, and they're imbued with the spirit, and they're drunk on their evilness, and they truly can afford the greatest wines, and they can drink these wines and be drunk on this, fine. Let them do it in this world. Because really, they have no care and they have no capital with which to go in the next. And that's why it says in an opposite Mishnah, these are the things you do without measure in this world. Good deeds, comforting mourners, respecting parents, going to the Beit Midrash and studying, being with the bride and groom is joyous, of course. But there's no end to Talmud Torah, to study. And things that seem like this, that you're not getting total reward for and joy. Why? Because your capital in the next world really lets you before God say, look at what I've done with my life. But the capital is all spent for the wicked. So in essence, the Gemara and the rabbinic philosophy on this matter answers an age-old problem of why the wicked prosper. This is one approach. The wicked prosper so they can get the transient reward of this world. But really, worry not. They have no reward in the Olam Haba. So it's quite a statement, because who's in that position to say? But if you motivate, if you move through life with such a sense that you're establishing your own kind of capital for the next world, even though we love this one so much, because the rabbis have enough statements to say, really, it's about this life too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not just collecting for the next world. Got to enjoy life, got to have joy, got to have simcha, got to have study, got to produce, got to be who you are, got to all these things that make you fruitful. But this is a way to think, according to Rav Chanan.
I find this is a very Catholic thought. Yeah. Okay, it's a little life in the next world is a very good Jewish book.
Well, that's why I tried to suggest that we balance that in a very different way. We balance it in the sense that our text that says you develop the capital for the next world is because your mitzvot in this world truly bring you simcha shel ha-mitzvah, the joy of living. And we have a verse in the Torah, v'chai behem, and you live by them. And we have bodily marriage, whereas the church went the direction of the priest who's celibate. You know, we have bodily joy, and we have the joy of life. So I don't want to overstate it, for sure. It's not only about the next world.
I'm interested in the conception of the role of wine in the temple as part of the sacrificial system. So I think there are two things that I'm not sure I really understand. Obviously, some of the sacrifice was to provide food for the Kohanim and the Levites.
Right.
Some of it was to provide things for God, savory smell from the incense. At least this is the way it's portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I have is about the wine, because I think it would have an impact on the way I would interpret this. So if the wine is there because the priests like to drink wine, and so bringing the wine as part of the sacrifice, then I have one view of it. If it's there because it's a heavenly drink, that it's a godlike drink, that there's something so important about it that it should be part of the sacrificial system.
It was
brought as libation as part of it, was it not?
We had water libation.
Water libation.
But no wine.
That's the Greeks.
Wine only comes in with the festival.
Okay. Right. And done for Kiddush. And a very different ritual in a rabbinic parlance. Wine is forbidden for any use by Kohanim and workers of the temple. And that comes directly deraita from after the death of Aharon's children. To move forward into some of the texts, the Gemara returns to describing how wine can ruin a person now. Rabbi Yitzchak says the following, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Mai dichiv al tere yayin ki yit adam. What is the meaning of that which is written? Do not look upon wine that's red. That's said in Proverbs. Al tere yayin. Don't look upon wine. Shema adim panehem shel rishaim. Top of 70a4 now. What does it do? It reddens the face of the wicked in this world. Shema'adim p'nehem shel rishaim ba'olam hazeh, u'malbin p'nehem la'olam haba, and it whitens their face in the world to come. So you get red in the face down here, full of anger, full of murderous intent, full of rage, full of red, and it whitens your face upstairs. You're embarrassed.
It's a vasodilator. So even if you're not mad, if you're drinking, you're going to get some people at least will get rid from the vasodilatation.
There you go.
That's for sure.
Another explanation of the same verse. Rava amar al tere yayin ki yit adam. Rava says when the verse states don't look upon wine that's red, this is what it means. Al tere yayin shacharito dam. Do not look longingly upon wine and overindulge in it. What? Because what? Shacharito dam. Because its end result is blood. It's blood. It will lead to the drinker's death, according to this note. And there's another that says Rashi, about three quarters of the way down, Sha'acharito Dam. It's the words Sha'acharito Dam are the first words on the narrow line about 10 lines up in the Rashi. If you're on the page, Sheyit She'acharito Dam, Sofo Yaharog Alav. In the end, he will actually murder for it. There are versions of the Rashi that say, Sofo She'yehareg Alav, that he will be killed by it. So depending on one yud, in which manuscript we have, we can read the Rashi in one or another ways. either way, not such a good end. Not such a good end.
This says Shaye Hareg Midin Ben Sarea, so because you might be, your end is that you'll be killed because you'll be a judge.
Yeah, because you'll be a killer. Okay. Now the Gemara, in terms of wine, keeps going. Rav Kahana Rame, Rav Kahani poses a contradiction. It's Kativ, Tirash, Vikarainan Tirosh. It's written in the Torah Tirash without any Vav, right? The word, he's doing word games. But we read this word according to the pronunciation handed down by tradition as Tirosh. We have a Kativ and a Kri. How it's written versus how it's read aloud. Zacha.
So it's how it's heard.
Right, we read it when we read the Torah as Tirosh, though it's written without a vav.
So that's like a convention. Anybody who is reading it will say Tirosh, even though it doesn't say it.
Correct. And that's why in the Torah that we have, the Herz Chumash or a copy of the Tanakh, it will give you a little star or an asterisk, and it will say, it's actually written like this without the vav, but here's how it's read. The Kri is this. And that's why there's a little kuf before the word in, with the nikudot. Oftentimes, the kativ, the way it's written in the Torah, in the you know, like kind of when you're reading through and following the verses, the word that's written like this will have no little vowel points if it's not actually read like that, and the vowel points will come kind of under the line down here to show you that that's how it's read. Zacha neserosh. If one merits after drinking wine, what? He'll become a leader. If you drink moderately. Lo zacha na'ase rash. But if you don't merit it, you're going to become very poor. Similar explanation, two potential results of drinking. Rava rame kativ yishamach. It's written with a shin. But what? Vikarinan. But it's read. Yishamach. We actually say it's going to be for making the person joyous. Zacha, the person merits it. Misamcho, wine's going to gladden your heart. Lo zacha, mishamamehu, it's going to destroy you. V'hainu d'amar Rava, and Rava said, chomra v'reichana pakachim, wine and fragrant scents have made me wise. So Rava ultimately comes around and says, I smell the havdala spices, I drink that wine on a Saturday night, even after Kiddush. Here's the point. I have a little bit more wine. Made me wise. I was able to see the world in a different way. I was able to enjoy the company of others. It's the social lubricant. I could be in discussions. I could think about the texts. But that's only if you merit it. What's the indication here to me? The indication is that they're very aware that there are different people when it comes to alcohol. That wine is sometimes stronger than others. That somebody has to moderate, be self-regulatory, be careful. This is the reason why they're including this in the general discussion. They're bringing traditions in. They're very aware. And they're also aware that it's an issue in general, and it had to do with Noah. Skip down more verses that allude to the evil effects of wine. Darish Oved Galilea. The Ober the Galilean expounded. You with me here? Shalosh Esrei Vavin Nemru Bayayin. 13 Vav prefixes were said in a section of the Torah discussing wine. Vayachel Noach ish hadama vayita karem. Noach, the man of the earth, debased himself and planted a vineyard. Vayesht minayayin vayishkar vayitgal betoch oholo. And he drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Vayarcham avi chanaan et ervat aviv vayaged l'shnei achav bachutz. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. Vayikach Shem vayefet et ha-simla vayasimu al shchem shnehem. And Shem and Yafet took a garment laid upon both their shoulders. Vayelchu acharonit vayichasu et ervat avihem ufnehem. And they walked backwards and covered their father's nakedness and their faces were turned away, and they saw not their father's nakedness. Vayiketz Noach miyeno v'yeda et asher asalo b'noach katan. And Noach awoke from his wine and realized what his small son had done to him. And he said, cursed is Canaan. So what does it lead to? For the rabbis, this chapter of Noach being uncovered by his son, the wine leading to his nakedness, was an absolute travesty. What does Noach do when he gets off the Teva, when he gets off the ark?
Plants a vineyard.
He plants a vineyard. Now, the notion of being a vineyard planter, again, according to the way McGovern sees it, is that it's a perfect kind of way to think about it, because the Eurasian grapevines in about the 13th century BCE came down to the Beirut area in through the ancient lands of Canaan. It's very interesting how it's kind of all matching up with biblical history and what they found archaeologically. That's one technicality, a note of scholarly work on the archaeological front. The other piece here is that Noah really is held up as someone who just could not do right by God. Call him an Ish Tzadik at the beginning. Call him a righteous guy who got the merits to build the ark. But, sorry, in the end, he misused one of God's greatest gifts. He really did. Continues.
I think there's the biblical narrative is crisp. It's minimal. There's much more, I think, going on there that's unsaid. That's my impression, and I think there's an implication of that in general. We don't know what happened. Something happened more than what is described.
I would think he would have been depressed seeing the world all destroyed, sort of like on the beach. Remember that movie? Pretty bleak scene.
But would you say that in the nature of the relationship among the sons, too?
Yes, I think something happened between the sons and Noah.
There on Midrash that one of them slept with the father.
Listen to how graphic the Gemara is going to get here, because what the Gemara is tuned into what you're saying. The Gemara wants to see what's happening. The Midrash here, this is Midrash, so this gets back to Agadata. This gets back to trying to figure out why the terseness of the text, what really happened, and they're reading it in a very, very powerfully negative way in terms of some of the relational pieces. Look further. Rav Shmuel. Rav Shmuel disputed the matter. Chad Amar Serso. One said that Ham castrated Noach. V'chad Amar Riva'o. And one said that he sodomized him. The Gemara explains the reasoning behind each opinion. Mande Amar Serso. The one who said that Ham castrated him derives this from the wording of Noach's curse. Mitoch Shekil Kalo. Barivii, since Ham ruined Noah by castrating him so that he could not get a fourth son. Kilolo barivii, Noah therefore cursed him through his fourth son, Canaan. Umanda amar rivao, and the one who said that Ham sodomized him, Gamar vayar vayar, derives this from a Gezerah Shava, comparing the expression and he saw with he saw. Now, Gezerah Shava is when I have an expression in one place that then means this, so over here the expression must mean the same. And I learn from this way to that way. Ketiv hacha, it's said here by Yar Chama v'Chanaan et Ervar Aviv. Here it's written in Cham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness. Uchetiv hatam, and it's written in a different place by Yar Otash Shechem ben Chamor, and Shechem the son of Chamor saw Dina, and he violated her. And therefore, the violation must be what I learned over here with the story of Noach. The Gemara analyzes the two views. Bishlama de Manda Amar Serso, Noach's actions are understandable according to the one who says that Ham castrated Noah. Mishum Hachi, Klili, Klilo, Berivii, because of this it's appropriate that Noach cursed Ham through his fourth son, Canaan. Eila l'man de marivao. But according to the one who says Chan sodomized Noach, ma'ishna rivii nalatye v'chedya. What is special about Chan's fourth son that explains why Noach specifically cursed him through? Ha v'ha havei. According to this view, both this, the sodomy and the castration occurred, and Chan both sodomized and castrated his father. So the story is negative either which way. Either one or both really occurred. And really, Noach, the man of the earth, debased himself and planted a vineyard. Debased himself. Next part of the Gemara. Vayachel Noach ish hadama vayita karem. The man of the earth debased himself and planted that vineyard. Amarev chista, amarev ukva. Bamrila Marukva Amar Rav Zakai, and Marukva said in the name of Rav Zakai, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Noach, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Noach, Noach lo haya lecha l'lamod me Adam HaRishon, Noach, should you not have learned to avoid wine from Adam, the very first human being? Shelo garam lo ela yayin, whose downfall was only caused by wine. Oh, this rebuke is implicit in the Torah's description of Noach as Ish Adamah. And Adam was created from the earth, but his progeny are born from a woman, and thus when the Torah describes Noah as a man of the earth, it alludes to the following rebuke. Noah, he should have learned about the evils of wine from Adam. Now, 57, note 57, goes with this next part of the Gemara. V'manda amaro to ilan she'acham imenu Adam rishon gefen aya. There's one who states that it wasn't a pomegranate and it wasn't an apple. What was it that Adam ate from?
The grapevine.
The Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer, Rabbi Meir says, Oto Ilan Chechal Adam Rishon Mimenu Gefen Hayo. It was a grapevine from which the first Adam drank from, ate from and drank from. The fermentation of the fruit that he knew nothing about happened naturally in the world because the natural process of creation led to the fermentation of the fruit of the vine, and the fruit of the vine was his downfall. The power here is, because the notion of time, we say poetically, 6 days, right? But we say that we can understand that in modernity, especially through the notion that that was a period of time and not necessarily the kind of Shaot, the hours that we think about.
Not even 6 days, so what day was the thing?
What it's saying is that there's a period of time that fermentation occurred. And what was it that the Midrashis, not us, 2,000 years ago, that the Midrashis purported that there was time for the grape to be fermented? And that inherent within creation is the notion of the wine, the one that was found in the universe, floating, that causes either a person to be able to moderate and use it in a way that's the social reality it is and the greatness of all that wine can be, or it's the downfall that led from the first person to the next, Noach, and then to other people who abuse it. And the concern we have is that we put in a social network of rituals and ways of helping people and ways of approaching this very fruit of the vine that do not make us either Dionysian cults or banqueteers with great wine pitchers or abusers of a gift of God. And that, I think, is the message of this beautiful page of Gemara.
No class next week.
Yeah, everybody, really wish you a very sweet Pesach.
Is that right? No question?
Right, it's the end of the second day of Passover. Right, next week is Passover. Yontif. Yeah. So we'll meet the next time right after that, though. I just do want to mention one thing to this class of learners, if I may, as we break for the night. So there's class that Thursday morning for the Sidur, for those who want it. B, we'll meet the following week. And that following week of Pesach begins 6 weeks of a learning program that... is this still recording?
Yeah.
Can we...
Oh, I thought you wanted.
No, thank you. Okay. Of a learning program.